America Looks Abroad, presented at this hour on Sunday afternoon by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, which is open to all who are interested in American foreign policy, offers accurate information on current world events. Can America defend its neutral rights? Is the question which will be discussed today by Mr. David H. Popper, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association. Mr. Popper.
Good afternoon. During the last fortnight, the British Empire, like Germany, has been running into some rather heavy weather in its conduct of the war. It has taken a buffeting in the American press because of its treatment of American rights and interests, a point we shall consider in a moment. It is faced with a bitter political campaign in Canada. It has antagonized the Japanese by seizing Germans aboard Japanese vessels, just a few miles off the coast of Japan. Its bid for support from the European neutrals, made by Winston Churchill on January 20th, has backfired sharply. These events are by no means crucial, but they are significant. Our own difficulties with the Allies are to us much more important. We have kept the cables warm with a series of diplomatic protests to London over the violation of our neutral rights. The American notes deal with four distinct subjects. First, we have sent a communication on the Allied blockade of German exports, which was put into effect on December 4th. International law permits a nation at war to cut off shipments bound for an enemy country, if these are contraband, that is, if they are of use in war. It does not, however, permit a nation to cut off the exports of its enemy to a neutral country. We therefore have good legal grounds for questioning the British in this instance. Still, it is very doubtful that we will push our protest on this point to extremes. For in the last war, the Allies successfully carried out a similar economic blockade of Germany. We protested, but only for the record. And violations of international law, although they may be illegal at the time, soon tend to become precedents, which others feel free to follow. The second point on which we are making representations to the British is the practice of forcing American vessels to call at Allied ports in order to make sure that no contraband arrives in Germany. As our State Department has pointed out, the Allied contraband control bases are, many of them, situated within the combat area proclaimed by the President under the Neutrality Act. Under our law, this area is barred to American ships and American citizens, so that the Allies are actually forcing American vessels to violate our laws when our ships are diverted for examination into Allied ports. In our second communication on this question, published only last Monday, we vigorously demanded that the forceful diversion of American ships into Mediterranean ports should cease. We were particularly put out because the evidence showed that our ships were detained three times as long as Italian vessels in this area. Here again, the textbook rules of international law are on our side. They allow countries at war to stop our merchant ships on the high seas and examine ships' papers there. But these ships may not be forced into port for further search unless there is clear evidence that they are carrying contraband. But once more, world war practice by the British and the French now forms a precedent for their conduct today. So our prospects are not very bright for getting much satisfaction on either the blockade of German exports or interference with American shipping on the high seas. The British may, however, agree to search our ships in Canadian ports outside the combat zone. A third incident on the diplomatic battleground, the exchange of notes on the Pan-American neutrality zone, falls in a different category. This time, the Allies have the law on their side. As you remember, on October 3rd last, the foreign ministers of the 21 American republics met at Panama City and adopted the Declaration of Panama, stating the inherent right of the Americas to see that the waters around the American continents were not disturbed by the hostile acts of any belligerents. What we were trying to do, in other words, was to keep the war out of a broad band of ocean extending 300 miles or more off the American coast, from the Canadian-American border southward. This was a novel doctrine, because international law has always provided that outside the customary 3-mile limit, the seas are a free highway, open to all, for all the legitimate purposes of peace or war. Both belligerents in the European war soon made it plain that they were not going to honor this so-called inherent right of the American republics. The Graf Spee affair indicated more clearly than any words could have done that to make the Declaration of Panama effective, we must either enforce it with our navy or somehow induce the belligerents to accept it voluntarily. Both Britain and France have sent us notes laying down the terms on which they might possibly agree not to commit hostile acts within the safety belt. But those terms are so sweeping that they obviously are not going to be fulfilled in the near future. The British note, for example, said that British warships could not be expected to stay out of American waters unless German naval vessels and supply ships were prevented from using the area as a sanctuary where they could take refuge from Allied attack. They even proposed that German shipping plying up and down the American coast must be halted, and that all German shipping in American harbors must be laid up for the duration of the war. What this means is that the British government will not suspend its warlike activities in the Pan-American safety zone, or anywhere else, until the German flag has disappeared from the waters concerned. Such conditions are hardly of help to us, for under those circumstances, hostile activities in American waters would cease anyhow, declaration or no declaration. Legally, the Allies are in an ironclad position on this question, and there would seem to be very little we can do to make the safety zone a reality. A more acute controversy has arisen over Britain's removal of American mail from American or other neutral vessels and censorship of letters addressed to neutral countries. We are ready to admit that the British government may open private mails bound for the United Kingdom or normally passing through that country on their way to their final destination. But we do protest strongly against interference with American mails on the high seas and on ships which the British have forced into British-controlled ports. Here again, the law is on our side. In 1907, both Britain and the United States had signed a convention on the subject of The Hague, which provides that the postal correspondence of neutrals or belligerents, and I am quoting, whatever its official or private character may be, found on the high seas on board neutral or enemy ships, is inviolable. But again, the British have reverted to their position of 1914-1918, when exactly the same controversy arose. They argued today, as they argued then, that a nation at war has a right to open mail to find out whether it contains contraband, such as securities, checks, drafts, or industrial diamonds. The British say that there is an organized traffic between the United States and Germany in these financial papers. Far from admitting that their action is illegal, they ask us why we don't protest to the Germans, who sink ships by mine and torpedo without any regard for the safety of either mails or passengers. On strictly legal grounds, the British arguments really do not meet the point. It is, of course, true that some financial instruments, such as securities, may reach the Germans in first-class mail. But the amount involved seems not to be very large, and the Germans could cash in on these securities without necessarily shipping them to the Reich. International financial transactions can be carried on by cable and wireless, as well as by mail. Yet our position, though strong, is far from perfect. In 1916, we covered the same ground in our dispute with the British. At that time, Secretary of State Lansing admitted that mail which contains securities and other financial instruments might be classed as merchandise and seized if it was contraband. Obviously, this was an entering wedge for the British, because it was clearly necessary to open mail to see whether it contained such financial instruments. In other words, we gave our case away at the start. And we did it intentionally, for Secretary Lansing says in his memoirs that our protest was made, quote, half-heartedly, as a matter of form, and with no intention to force the issue, end quote. That was done for two reasons, because of sympathy for the Allied cause and because of a desire to retain freedom of action if we ever became a belligerent. As a matter of fact, after we entered the war, we ourselves censored all mails touching American ports. so that we cannot logically complain if the British, for example, stop American clipper planes on their way to Europe via Bermuda and search the mails there. Now, these squabbles over neutral rights are bound to create intense irritation against the states controlling the seas in time of war. We, too, are a world power with a first-class naval establishment, and it is not easy for Americans passively to suffer economic losses and personal inconvenience because of a war in which we are not directly involved. But the United States is obviously confronted with an insoluble dilemma. Many of us sympathize with the Allies and do not wish to bludgeon them into changing their war policies, which are for them a matter of life or death. Yet we have rights of our own to uphold. We have yielded many of these under the neutrality law and have done a great deal to facilitate the Allies' control of our overseas trade. If we suspect that in spite of this, Britain and France are unnecessarily interfering with our affairs, we tend to become irritated, and with good reason. What begins as a minor exchange of diplomatic notes may become a very serious controversy. This was exactly the situation into which we drifted in 1916. After 2 years of protest to both sides in the war, popular indignation against both the Allies and Germany rose toward the boiling point. In September 1916, we passed legislation which permitted the President to prohibit the importation of products from Britain and France into this country if they did not cease interfering unjustly with our exports and our mails. We also authorized the President to prevent vessels which discriminated against American goods or shippers from leaving American ports. We never used these retaliatory powers because our anger over the Allied moves was swallowed up in our vastly greater indignation over the German submarine campaign. But today, ironically enough, our neutrality law, by preventing American ships and citizens from entering the combat area in Western Europe, has saved us so far from difficulties of this type with the Germans. What shall we do this time if more and more Americans protest to the State Department against the Allied war policies? Now, it would not be fair to say that this has yet become an alarming problem. Protection of American neutral rights is only one small portion of our broad foreign policy, which strives to protect many other interests as well. There are those who believe that these interests can best be defended by a policy of strict aloofness from the warring portions of the world. They believe that since we have given up so many of our rights in the Neutrality Act, we ought not logically to fight for any others. We should realize, in other words, that this is a totalitarian war, to be waged by any and all means at the disposal of the belligerents, and we should not resist their measures. Others view the European struggle in a different light. They are convinced of the justice of the French and British cause, and would therefore like to see this country fall in with all measures which would aid the Allies against Germany, even at a considerable cost to ourselves. Eventually, one of these views may well prevail. But meanwhile, Americans are going to clamor for protection of their rights abroad, and especially in an election year, the administration is going to defend these rights, on paper. In view of the fundamental sympathies of the American public and the Washington administration, however, we are not likely to do more than protest for the time being. But in the long run, it would perhaps be wisest for the Allies to convince this country that they are doing what they can to minimize the inconvenience and the loss to us. Then, with goodwill on both sides, it might be possible to reach agreement on specific questions. We recognize the need for war measures, but we should like to feel that they are no more stringent than necessary.
You have been listening to Mr. David H. Popper, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, speaking in the America Looks Abroad series. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. So if you are interested in knowing the facts behind the headlines, send for a free copy of the weekly bulletin written by the people you hear on this program and carrying an article by Mr. Popper. Address your letter or postcard to the Foreign Policy Association, number 8, West 40th Street, New York City. And tune into this station next Sunday at 3:15 to hear another speaker in the series America Looks Abroad. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.